From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, it's day two of our Jobline series. We'll talk with Rob Henken of the Wisconsin Policy Forum about the historical challenges our public transit has faced when trying to connect different counties.
I think the fundamental problem is that if you simply look at it on a passenger per bus hour basis, which is the standard used by transit systems, these routes are not going to measure up.
Our Beats Me series finds out about free tuition promise programs. Essayist Art Sear mourns the loss of secrecy in our intelligence operations, and how experiencing a fringe festival elsewhere encouraged writer Dasha Kelly to participate in Milwaukee's.
To see these performers from across the country, and they're standing on stilts, and they're pretending to be polar bears, and they're using bananas to tell their stories in theater, and all of this counted.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. This week, Lake Effect is exploring the end of the Milwaukee County Transit Service Jobline. Route 57 ends service this Saturday. The Jobline was put into place to transport workers from Milwaukee to jobs in Waukesha County, but this is far from the first route of its kind to help people travel between counties. But from light rail to buses, Milwaukee intercounty transportation has always had a bumpy road. While industrial rail is still a strong presence here in the city, our only passenger rail options are Amtrak or our new streetcar system, the Hop. Rob Henken of the Wisconsin Policy Forum says that one major obstacle to successful and efficient bi-county transportation has been a lack of regional transit authorities. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about Milwaukee County's transit obstacles and what factors have led to current cuts in services.
Once upon a time, there were all sorts of commuter rail options for people, ranging from a very comprehensive streetcar system in Milwaukee all the way to interurban service that connected Milwaukee to points north like Sheboygan and points south like Racine, Kenosha, and all the way to Chicago. So a whole range of service. In the early 1990s was the time when there was renewed discussion about two things. Number one, should we look at transportation and transit in particular from a regional perspective instead of having individual counties and municipalities struggling to create their own transportation solutions for their own citizens? And number two, we had an opportunity, a golden opportunity, to bring rail back here because there was the availability of, at the time, $289 million of federal money that ostensibly could have been used to build a light rail system from downtown Milwaukee all the way into Waukesha.
So going back to the attempt to expand the light rail, what kind of challenges was coming up with that? Why do you think it didn't go forward?
Well, I could probably talk for about an hour on that question, Audrey.
We'll dedicate Lake Effect to this whole question.
Yes. It was a very interesting time. So this money was available, and ostensibly the solution that was being looked at or the concept that was being looked at was, could we have light rail? Light rail trains typically going as fast as 55, 60 miles per hour when on dedicated right-of-way. But the beauty of light rail is you can also bring it up to city streets. So you can both sort of serve a streetcar-like function, but also, depending on how you design the system, could have created a rapid transit mechanism to get commuters off of I-94 going east-west and west-east. And so at the beginning, there was an alternatives analysis. It involved officials from both Waukesha County and Milwaukee County. The east-west corridor was the designated area for the use of these federal funds, and that area was defined as roughly the lake all the way out to the city of Waukesha. So that necessarily, per federal qualifications, had to involve officials from Waukesha and Milwaukee County. Well, mind you, this was happening at a time when we had our so-called sewer wars. So there was a lot of disgruntlement between Waukesha County officials and particularly the mayor of the city of Milwaukee, John Norquist, at the time. There were other issues that emerged that made regional cooperation not an easy thing to do. And in many ways, this battle over light rail, it got caught up in these other animosities that had developed. There was a feeling that Milwaukee wanted to tap into the deep pockets of Waukesha County residents to build a light rail system that would largely benefit Milwaukee. There was certainly a tinge of liberal versus conservative politics here. Spending hundreds of millions of dollars on a rail system, whether or not the funds were largely coming from the federal government, was seen as anathema to some, given the projected ridership, which perhaps wouldn't have been more than 25, 30,000 per day. So all of these things sort of mixed together to have this be a very volatile issue and really the poster child. And in terms of political ideology for conservatives, this was seen as the prime example of government wanting to spend money where it wasn't necessary. From the left side of the aisle, it was, hey, what a great opportunity to modernize our transit system and look at the billions of dollars that we want to invest in highways so that wealthier commuters can get back and forth in their cars, isn't it reasonable to suggest that a $400 or $500 million investment in a first-class transit system so that people without cars would have similar high-quality transportation, wasn't that a worthwhile investment?
It seems that all these transportation issues over the years are inherently political between counties, regions. So why don't we have a regional transit authority?
Well, it's a great question. And I think looking at the answer, I think it really sort of demonstrates our inability, whether rightly or wrongly, to see either the four-county metro region or the seven-county metro region as a region as opposed to these unique jurisdictions. And in many metro areas our size, a function like transit is dealt with on a regional basis. You don't necessarily want to have municipal or county boundaries determine where bus lines stop or where rail lines stop. And so to the extent that you see the need for mass transit that will serve a larger regional population, having a regional governmental entity be the funder and the administrator of that service just makes a lot of sense. Here we don't do that. So when we see bus routes that go from Milwaukee County into Waukesha County, depending on the potential need for that to bring workers to jobs, you get into some very dicey political issues about who pays what share and who's benefiting from that. In that case, is it the Waukesha County employer or is it the Milwaukee County citizen who's using the bus? And so how do you divvy up the financing? And so it's just been very difficult. But yes, in many other places, there's a regional transit authority. We had that conversation in earnest in the early 1990s, and a plan had been developed by the Regional Planning Commission on how to structure and fund an RTA, a regional transit authority, and six of the seven county boards turned that down. Milwaukee County was the one that didn't, but even didn't give it full approval. They wanted some changes in the financing plan. And so we struck out there, and I think it's really hampered any efforts going forward to talk about regional transit, whether it be bus or rail.
So with rail kind of reaching all of these, you know, roadblocks, so to speak, going forward, how did the bus line either try to, you know, take some of that fallout or supplement what wasn't being done by rail?
Well, so first of all, it's important to understand there is inter-county regional bus service. Wisconsin Coach Lines provides it. There are a few bus routes that Milwaukee County Transit System administers that do cross county lines. So clearly, you know, it's disappointing to me that the argument here has so often been about the mode, whether it's rail or bus. I would much prefer to see it, and who am I to say that, but if we could instead focus on the type of transit that best serves individuals. You can think of it as there's localized transit, which are buses that typically are city buses in the case of MCTS in the city of Milwaukee that stop frequently, that provide rides for people who are going to destinations for 3 or 4 miles away. There's then express transit, which maybe is for lengthier travel, 5 or 10 miles. The stops are spaced a little further apart. And again, that then can be done by either rail or bus. And then there's rapid transit, which in many places, rail has been argued to be a more effective way of doing that. But buses certainly can be used for rapid transit to take people distances of 15, 20 miles for their morning commute, Often one of the keys there is having a dedicated right-of-way, which again can be either for a bus or a train. And so here we are. There's a plan on the table for Milwaukee County to implement the region's first bus rapid transit route from downtown out to the regional medical center. So buses can take the place of rail. There are pros and cons. One of the pros is buses can be certainly less expensive in terms of the infrastructure needed. One of the cons is that rail, for whatever reason, tends to draw more riders than buses, even if all of the operating characteristics are similar.
Milwaukee County Transit System has tried over the years to have dedicated routes at the very least. And of course, with the series, we're talking specifically about Route 57, also referred to as the job line. So it's running out of funding by the end of this month. What are your concerns about it ending? And did it, I don't want to say, was it doomed to fail from the beginning because funding was short term?
This is certainly not the first time that a so-called job line has been put into place. The name is new, but the concept of trying to specifically introduce bus service that would be designed to bring City of Milwaukee residents out to industrial parks or areas where there are significant concentrations of jobs in the suburbs, there have been many attempts to do that.
What are some of those past examples?
There have been routes that have gone out to Menominee Falls and out to New Berlin, out to Quad Graphics in Sussex, for example. And so there's a few problems. Actually, the Wisconsin Policy Forum did a whole paper on this concept 3 or 4 years ago, because when you think about it, well, there's a need for those suburban employers to get workers. There's a need for workers to have access to family-supporting jobs. You can take a map and look on paper, and you or I could say, well, boy, here's a route that would appear to make some sense. The problem is that ridership on these routes, because it's longer distance service and it's not designed to serve points in between, ridership, comparably speaking to some of these more localized routes, is lower. There is a need for a higher public subsidy to support the route. And another problem is that one of the experiences in introducing these routes in the past is that they initially are successful. They bring workers out to jobs, but as soon as these workers have sustained employment, they opt to buy automobiles and they stop taking the bus. Now, that's anecdotal. I don't know that that's been proved, but we've heard that time and again from the transit operators. The other problem is that ridership tends to ebb and flow with the state of the economy. At times when the suburban employers are doing lots of hiring, there's healthy ridership in these routes. Once they've reached the point where they're not doing as much hiring, again, the ridership can go down. So I think the fundamental problem is that if you simply look at it on a passenger per bus hour basis, which is the standard used by transit systems, these routes are not going to measure up very well with other more quote-unquote productive routes. And so when financial challenges emerge, the first place the transit leaders have to look to cut is these less productive routes, and these tend to be the less productive. We actually argued in our report that maybe there needs to be an adjustment to the criteria we use in determining which service to cut. But again, there's no silver bullet here. It all links back to our unsustainable way that we're attempting to finance transit here in Milwaukee County. And so that's been one of the real fundamental problems.
So, yeah, go into the unsustainable way of financing these routes, this whole system.
So we've already talked about the fact that we're pretty unique in terms of not having regional transit authorities here. We are also very unique in terms of not having a dedicated funding source to support our transit system. So virtually all metro areas our size have said, look, there's a certain revenue stream that we are going to dedicate to transit, and transit is not going to compete with other governmental services. It doesn't mean that that's going to provide, you know, ample resources. If you're relying on a dedicated sales tax and we're in a recession, you're going to have some revenue challenges. But the act of dedicating the dollars means that the transit system has some assurance of steady funding over time. The problem with Milwaukee County's transit system and not having that dedicated funding source is that the transit system has to compete with all other county functions during the course of budget deliberations each year. So here you have transit competing with parks and behavioral health services and sheriff services and court services, et cetera. So that's number one. Number two is that there's no revenue authority. So it's not just the lack of the dedication, but in many, in most other major metro areas, there is some capability for either a regional transit authority or a county government to have a specific sales tax, for example, in place. Here, Milwaukee County's hands are tied. The county relies heavily on the property tax. There's sales tax authority for up to a half cent. That was used and exhausted 20-something years ago. And so there's really outside of the wheel tax, and that's an interesting issue because there was a proposal by the county executive to double the size of the wheel tax just a couple years ago that would have started to really deliver a more sustainable stream of funding to the transit system. And we actually raised the concept at the time of declaring that to be the dedicated funding source, to say if we're going to do a wheel tax, let's only have that money go to the transit system. That was rejected by the county board. There was an advisory referendum. People said they didn't want a wheel tax. They weren't given much context for that question. But if you ask an individual if they want to pay more to register their vehicle, they're likely to say no.
Right. So funding, an obvious issue going forward. What do you think are any other greatest transportation challenges in the immediate future for Milwaukee if you say, you know, it's unsustainable?
Yeah. Well, I think a really interesting challenge, and I have no idea whether it's a threat or an opportunity, is just the increase in the number of modes of transportation. The introduction, of course, of Lyft and Uber. Scooters now coming to downtown Milwaukee, which aren't a great example, but actually could be a real opportunity for transit, because one of the big challenges we've identified is, you know, these suburban routes can get people out to the suburbs, but often the jobs are dispersed over a 1 or 2 or 3 mile area. That last mile challenge is really difficult. And that's another reason that these longer distance transit routes have tended not to work very well. Well, might scooters be a partial solution to that, or might Uber or Lyft be a partial solution to that? So I think it's both an opportunity and a challenge. There's also been some concern that actually transit ridership is dropping because of the availability of these alternatives, which makes the revenue challenge more difficult, which, again, exacerbates the long-term financial challenge facing Milwaukee County if that tends to happen here.
Having looked back at the transportation options, say, in the 1980s, 1990s, so let's fast forward 50 years, hypothetically. What do you think Milwaukee's public transportation history will look like?
Well, we're at a real interesting point in time. I don't know that I thought I would live to see the day when we were going to introduce new rail transit in Milwaukee, and we've done that with the HOP. Obviously, whether we're going to extend the HOP is already generating a great deal of controversy, and I think whether we should do that is it's a very difficult question given all of the other financial needs that our city government faces. That said, on the one hand, you could envision having a much more comprehensive level of streetcar service serving the direct downtown area and adjacent downtown area. You can envision more people working from their homes, telecommuting. And so, you know, I think the question of the future of rubber tire bus service, I think it's going to have to work hard to find its niche given all of these other factors that are happening around us. But my sense is that 50 years from now, there's still going to be a need for publicly provided mass transit for people who cannot afford the other means that are available. Uber and Lyft, of course, while new and great for some, still cost a lot of money and is more expensive than taking the bus. So I think that need's always going to be there, whether it's bus, whether we've added more express and rapid service to our current largely localized system. I think those are big questions. But I think that there's still going to be that need.
Well, Rob Henkin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rob Henkin is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski as part of our End of the Job Line series. Tomorrow, we'll talk with riders on Route 57 to find out how they're feeling about the end of the line. Back in May, WUWM's Chuck Kornbach reported on a series of metal sculptures that were taking shape in Milwaukee's Menominee Valley. The People of the Road sculptures honor the thousands of men and women who worked for a passenger and freight rail transportation giant known as the Milwaukee Road.
The railroad was officially known in its later years as the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific. That's because in its heyday, it operated on 10,000 miles of track in the Midwest and Pacific Northwest. But for much of its nearly 140 years, the carrier was simply called the Milwaukee Road. Milwaukee was a key part of the company's success. A huge rail car and locomotive shop at the southwest corner of the Menominee Valley employed more than 5,000 people. When that building closed and the financially troubled railroad dissolved in the mid-1980s, it was a mournful time in the city. As captured in the 1987 song, Come Bugle Blow, by Milwaukee folk singer Larry Penn.
What can you play for a ragged old soul but taps for the Milwaukee Road? Come bugle blow for the Milwaukee Road, a rusty old road, a crusty old road. Come bugle blow for a busted old road, for the Milwaukee Road bugle blow.
The passing of the Milwaukee Road no doubt remains painful to many, even today. But others are hoping time has healed some of the wounds. Former Milwaukee Mayor John Norquist recently tried to offer a humorous remembrance.
I remember the workers coming out of here, going through the tunnel across the river, and then going to the National Liquor Bar to cash their checks.
Norquist spoke this month at an unveiling of two of the five sculptures that are planned for the People of the Road Monument. The monument, steel depictions of male and female railroad employees doing work, is going up along the Hank Aaron State Trail just west of the 35th Street Viaduct. It's in the Menominee Valley Community Park, which is where the railcar shop was. The president of the trail's Friends Group, Dan Adams, cheered the unveiling.
Paul! Woo!
About 150 people attended the event, including David Pierce, who briefly worked for the Milwaukee Road.
I was what you call a Gandhi dancer, so I used an 8-pound maul hammer and I would pound spikes into the rail, and we repaired the tracks, a federal project to repair them from Wauwatosa to Watertown. That was my 3-month career with the Milwaukee Road. I was glad to move on, believe me.
Other members of the Pierce family stayed longer. A brother worked for the road as an electrician, while their father and grandfather were locomotive engineers. David says he's glad to see the sculptures.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's important that organized labor is, you know, recognized. We were in a union there, and that was a way for the workers to be treated fairly, work in safe working conditions. There's always somebody to look out for you.
The person looking out now for the story of the workers is the creator of the sculptures, Milwaukee artist Richard Taylor. Taylor uses an angle grinder in his River West studio to show how he smoothed the rough edges of the rusted steel sculptures. Taylor says his father, who worked briefly for the Milwaukee Road, helped with some of the metal grinding. The artist says he hopes the monument honors all the workers.
I know I could have gone in other directions with the iconography of locomotives and rail cars and tracks and that sort of thing, but I thought the people should really be honored because it was such a rich history, supported so many workers and families for decades and decades.
This week, Taylor says he was given the go-ahead to work on the third sculpture and hopes to have it up by August. The Friends of the Hank Aaron State Trail is still trying to raise the money for the other two figures. Chuck Quernbach, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
WUWM's Chuck Quernbach reported on this story in May. The third sculpture has since been installed, and there is a photo of it at WUWM.com. After a short break, we'll hear from education reporter Emily Files, who answers a listener's question about tuition promise programs. Lake Effect returns with Beats Me in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Several states are trying to make college more affordable by creating free tuition promise programs. Such programs allow students to attend community college or sometimes public universities for free. There are no state-supported promise programs in Wisconsin, but some institutions have created their own. Last year, the state's flagship school, UW-Madison, announced Bucky's Promise Program, which guarantees free tuition to lower-income students. One WUWM listener wondered why Madison and not other schools. Education reporter Emily Files looked for answers as part of our Beats Me series.
When it was announced a year ago, the Bucky's Promise program wasn't an entirely new thing at UW-Madison. That's according to Financial Aid Associate Director Greg Offerman. He says Madison was already giving full-ride scholarships to students with family incomes under $58,000. Bucky's Promise is simply a way to advertise that up front.
It was kind of like, how do we tell people on the front end, you know, what they can qualify for based on their family's income? So kind of pulled back the curtain a bit from the what can be a confusing financial aid application process.
Bucky's Promise is a last dollar scholarship, which means it fills in the difference after students' federal and state aid is applied to tuition. Free tuition was a major factor in student Mayanne Montoute's decision. Montoute graduated from Riverside University High School in Milwaukee. After being accepted to Madison, she learned that she qualified for Bucky's Promise.
I just needed something that I could manage because I didn't want a lot of student loans when I graduate because I come from a low-income families. So it was like kind of all up to me.
Montoute's tuition is being paid for through the Promise Program, but also with a federal Pell Grant. Pell Grants are awarded to students with significant financial need. Many elite schools like Madison have relatively small numbers of Pell-eligible students. That speaks to why Madison has a free tuition program and other UW institutions do not. At UW-Milwaukee, more than a third of students are low income. Here's UWM Vice Chancellor of Finance, Robin Van Harpen.
In terms of what we saw out of UW-Madison for lower income students, that particular program is challenging for Milwaukee because we have such a much greater body of students who are Pell eligible and have that financial need and a much smaller revenue base overall than Madison does.
Promise programs have become common at Wisconsin technical colleges. 11 out of 16 have free tuition offerings, but they're limited to students who meet certain income and academic criteria. All of those programs are privately funded. The first one launched at Milwaukee Area Technical College in 2015 for Pell-eligible students just out of high school. MATC President Vicki Martin says at first a promise program seemed unaffordable, but then she considered the last dollar structure, which means the school is only paying the tuition not covered by Pell Grants.
And when I looked at how much our students were receiving in Pell Grants, and I looked at the difference that we would have to pay, I thought we could do this.
Most of the MATC Promise students get large enough Pell Grants to cover their full tuition, meaning the school's free tuition program is based mostly on money the students would receive anyway. But Martin says the clear message of the Promise program helps get those students in the door.
I will tell you what they do understand is college will be free. Your tuition will be free. That they do understand, and they will come forward and say, okay, what do I need to do?
Although there are a number of College Promise programs in Wisconsin, they're supported on a school-by-school basis, which means they're limited in the number of students served. At least a dozen states have taken legislative action to make community college free, but Wisconsin's legislature has not rallied around that idea. In past years, Republican lawmakers rejected Democratic proposals for statewide College Promise programs, saying Wisconsin can't afford it. But Democrats haven't given up on the idea of debt-free college. Lawmakers plan to bring up the topic again this year. Emily Files, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Don't forget, you can submit your own Beats Me story ideas at WUWM.com. There are a number of jokes about intelligence work, but the punchline is always some variation of, but if I told you, I'd have to kill you. Lake Effect foreign policy contributor Art Sears says, all joking aside, secrecy and discretion are crucial components of this kind of work.
Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe of Texas has been withdrawn as the White House nominee to be Director of National Intelligence, and that is in the nation's interest. His main qualification was aggressively badgering Special Counsel Robert Mueller on the media stage, which is no serious qualification at all. Intelligence work demands discretion along with skill. Silence is essential, can be golden, and clearly is especially hard to find in today's tweet-happy Washington, D.C. Regarding media visibility, after the 2016 elections, the heads of the CIA, FBI, NSA, National Security Agency, and the Director of National Intelligence launched a public relations offensive highlighting how Russia, including President Vladimir Putin, meddled in the 2016 elections, including hacking Clinton campaign email. With great fanfare, they met with President-elect Donald Trump to present evidence behind the conclusions. With equal hype, the top spooks testified before the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. There is no denying that Russian hackers, and no doubt human agents as well, meddled in the 2016 elections. How much this affected the results is extremely uncertain. The fact that they interfered is undeniable. President Barack Obama revealed these developments in October 2016, just before voting took place. Why did the intel officials go public with lights, cameras, and melodrama? Because they wanted to protect themselves in the contemporary political warfare of Washington. Politicians want to score points with voters, and Putin remains a scary bear. But protecting our nation involves secrecy. These bureaucrats were shielding themselves. The national media soap opera related to intelligence continues. Controversy and associated political consternation swirled for a time around President Trump's removal of the security clearance of former CIA Director John Brennan, who has become a harsh public critic of the administration. Again, in earlier periods, protecting national security dictated maintaining disciplined silence, a durable truth worth remembering. Traditionally, intelligence work has involved balancing electronic and human surveillance. Today, our government de-emphasizes human agents. In World War II and the Cold War, that dimension was vital. It still is, as our British partners well understand. Current emphasis on public relations by officials is the other side of reliance on relatively automated electronic tools. Former Republican Congressman Daryl Issa of California, a successful tech entrepreneur, was insightful in office analyzing intelligence agencies. In 2016, he publicly opposed FBI legal efforts to try to force Apple to decrypt the iPhone. Issa and General Michael Hayden, former director of both the CIA and the NSA, argued Apple should not be required to comply. Government professionals should handle such hard tasks, as eventually they did, with outside help. In November 1959, President Dwight Eisenhower spoke at the cornerstone ceremony of the new CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. He emphasized that in this field, quote, success cannot be advertised, failure cannot be explained. In the work of intelligence, heroes are undecorated and unsung, often even among their own fraternity, unquote. In that era, there was automatic, not to be confused with automated, understanding of this. In evaluating public office candidates, consider the degree to which they express maturity and selflessness rather than political expediency in addressing questions of national security. That includes current presidential candidates. When you find such candidates who are serious about defense and national security, support them as fully as possible. Look for signs of selflessness along with disciplined attention to policy. Political and related government experience is desirable as long as that is combined with other qualities. Serving our nation is an honor.
Lake Effect contributor Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business, and he directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. We'll take one last break and then meet two local artists who will be taking part in this weekend's Milwaukee Fringe Festival. Lake Effect returns with that conversation right after this on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The fourth annual Milwaukee Fringe Festival takes place this weekend. It features more than 25 performances, plus roving and visual artists as well. The performances take place over the weekend at the Todd Weir Theater, the Peck Pavilion, and Vogel Hall, and it promises to be another exciting and diverse lineup. Local artists Dasha Kelly and Chad Pahochki are both taking part in this year's festival, and they join me in the studio now. Dasha and Chad, it's great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
You're both performers. What is doing something in a fringe festival? What does it do? How is it different from a normal, quote-unquote, performance that you might do?
I would have to say for me it's the permission to count this little creative expression of life art and theater and performance, and not that you don't know that in the middle of performing this outlook on life, but it's hard to categorize it in a way. So I want to say I had a frame of reference for the Fringe Festival, having gone to the National Performers Network, was invited there, and to see these performers from across the country, and they're standing on stilts, and they're pretending to be polar bears, and they're using bananas to tell their stories in theater, and all of this counted, and all of them were being booked, and all of them were traveling, and not being particularly a theater person, it was really exciting to say, oh, so it is a place for my little way to be creative, my little way to perform. So when Chad introduced me to this Fringe Festival thing that was going on, I'm like, huh? What? On the fringe sometimes can make you feel like you are outside, you're not included, that what you're doing is too weird and too special. And we are outside, and it isn't traditional, and the way we want to tell these stories and perform our art is weird and special. So to have a place where all of it can be brilliant at the same time, it's exciting.
And Chad, for you, same thing?
Same thing, and it's a space for me to sit on a cake.
Yeah, you don't get to do that usually.
No.
In your normal work day.
It was a really nice German chocolate cake that I brought on stage, and I was wearing a thobe from Saudi Arabia, and I was reading a poem by Galway Canal about his son's birthday and how his son sat on a cake, and I said, well, I got to sit on this cake to reenact that experience. And a space for me to work with local artists like Dasha and bring in other talents around town. Sometimes these artists and musicians, they don't connect with each other for whatever reason. They've been working in town for 20, 30 years. I call them up and they're like, I've never worked with, you know, Josh and Steve and ever worked together. And they're in the room collaborating and they're just light years ahead of me musically. And it's just like, it's a thing of genius to see them at work. And so it's a space to bring in some collaboration and also to get some money in artists' hands to make sure
it's pretty direct, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not a lot of overhead it's passing through and filtering through before it gets to them.
I mean, they got some more fundraising to do to really cover costs, but we're able to cover some costs through some sponsorships. So for me, I get to do, whatever I want in a real respectful way and experiment with ideas that I muse over for months. You know, sometimes it's months it took me to get to say, I'm not going to talk this year, like last year. I didn't talk. I just danced with the ladder while someone's playing the harp. And I get to do that. And then people are like, wow, that's great. And I'm like, really? Really? My neighbors didn't think so when I was rehearsing in my backyard last night, but that's okay.
So glad you're here.
Yeah. I love that idea that something like a fringe festival allows what we might think of as off-the-wall creativity, where it's the crazy stuff that doesn't make it into your more normal creative process. You know, you're free to experiment, to get those creative juices flowing in a way that, you know, most of the time I think artists are focused on, we've got to get this done. There's a show we have to do, a painting I have to finish, a musical thing we have to rehearse, whatever it is. And that is included in this, but it seems like there's
more room to do, you know, to do all of it, all of it in. Yeah,
I would imagine in some of the shows I was able to sit in on. So over the course of the years, I was part of the advice tent. So Anja, Natanja, Anja Seeger had this session where we were writers of different stripes. We were under a tent. We all had a typewriter. She found typewriters for everybody, and we were typing out advice. So people came, and they were poetic. They were short stories. And then the next year, it is adding a poem to this dinosaur cake-sitting experience. So all of them have a message, though, and all of them are a story, though. So the freedom is to be able to tell that story, however, and in some cases, the freedom is to be able to have that conversation. So I'm thinking about with the show that I'm doing, Making Cake, we had a chance to do like a preview up at a arts festival a year or so ago, and I could just see the faces of these Performing Arts Center folks going, man, sure, and their eyes are wide, and it's that stunned, I'm not sure what to say, because I'm sure they're processing, how are they going to sell this to Margaret? They're trying to figure out all of the, like you said, all of the other business elements of this art experience that they personally had a moment, but you have to imagine, are all the 300 seats going to have a moment? Am I going to get my donors to? Are we going to be able to make posters that? Is it going to fit in the overall theme of our exhibit? Who we are. Yeah. So those kind of questions that have really, I think, strangled our conversation about the arts and creativity in general, because then the creativity is only about whether you're an artist or not. And artists, yes, obviously are creative, but it stunts the discussion of how creative the dentist is, how creative that mom is, how creative we are in getting up every day. So I get it. The business part is business, and that's how we all, for the most part, try to keep food in our refrigerators. But there are other conversations that creatives are looking to have, and to be able to have a space to create that piece of work that tells that story, introduces that discussion, and you're not concerned about Margaret and ticket sales and whether or not you're going to have to respond to 3,000 angry emails, and all those things may still happen, but you got to do that thing. And that's not to suggest that all the performances are radical, and they're not all crazy weird. There are some radical and there are some mm-hmm. crazy weird, but by and large, a place to just not have to worry about so much of the business end of things, that once it gets out of your hands, this art is in your hands. You know, who's going to be there? You know, they're going to take this show, they're going to hear this story, they're going to experience this conversation as the artist created and intended it to be. And we don't get to do that very often.
Again, it gives you that space, the room to do all of that and to have those conversations and to bring people into those conversations. Yeah. I mean, I think it's important for artists to just be able to express, and I use the word artists, anyone who's doing this, I think, is an artist, but it then allows whoever's watching it to be part of that dialogue and to be part of whatever the response is to whatever the story is.
Yeah, and sometimes, like, as you're creating the work for this Fringe Festival, you don't have, like, if you're in a regular theater company, you've got your core audience and, like, the Margarets, and you're thinking about them, you want to program to them, and you also want to bring in the new audience, so you think about how do we attract new audiences, or how do we support a new community initiative so we can be a part of this conversation that's happening or perked up in the community. Whereas with this, it's my approach has been, I'm not really sure who's going to be there, because I'm not trying to get my friends and family to come only. They're invited, but a lot of them shy away from these kind of performances that I do, unless I bring cake.
That you don't sit in.
Yeah, that's it. I did. You know, pulled that one out of the back.
Yeah.
And you kind of get to experiment with that conversation, how you approach it, like breaking down the fourth wall and entering the house and talking to people and seeing, you know, who's going to step forward and not knowing their response. And in a real way, is kind of scary to do as a performer, but, you know, it puts people on edge and allows them to participate in a way they normally don't get to. So it allows that space, too, to break down some of those other rules of, like, you as an audience member can come on stage with me and be a part of the show. And then when you get a little too far, one guy took a little too far, and I had to sit on his lap to get him to stop messing with me because he disrupted the flow. And he knows he is.
Yeah. So how does doing this for both of you influence what you do in the rest of your practice? How has it changed how you write or how you think about your performance in non-fringe things?
I would say I was just talking to my husband this week about the process that preparing for this has layered into me. So not being a theater person and definitely haven't done a lot of performances, I have my way about how I've gone about making those things happen. So, and I've done a version of this production before, so this is a rework and it's a rewrite and it's leveling up. And so, and part of that process is leveling up how I'm able to deliver this. It gave me a It gives me a platform to imagine it beyond the Fringe Festival, to imagine it beyond Milwaukee, to imagine it beyond just, air quotes, just a theater production. So for me, it's an opportunity to do engagement. For me, it's an opportunity to it's my tool to invite a conversation. And this becomes a centerpiece to how to bring people to the discussion, things that I'm able to offer before and after. I mean, there's cake, right? So it's a way, you know, hey, cake is
a theme. I know
where you
got that idea from.
It's our theme.
It's a theme. Cake is the theme.
Yeah. Cake is a good theme, yeah. I have to say.
So. Yeah. But I would say it's given me an opportunity to, in real life, see myself and my work, not just this production, but myself and my work, to have legs outside of this weekend where I don't know that I would have seen that. I mean, we've talked about it, I've had dreams of it, and it sure would be a great idea and it'd be nice one day if. And different from, oh my goodness, have to figure out how to put this whole production together for the official theater. And not that the Fringe Festival is any less of a theater. I mean, we are going to be in the Marcus Center, right?
R.E. Theater.
Theater.
Yes.
R.E.
But it's an invitation to see in a production kind of a way different. So me personally, it gives me a chance to see beyond a show. It gives me a chance to really imagine how to put all the pieces together for my personal work, which is I've always been crafting this career where, yes, I'm an artist, and yes, I create things, and yes, I perform, but I also teach, I facilitate conversations, and all of those are part of my art. For me, all of those are part of how and why I do the events and write the things and tell the stories and perform the stuff. So this is a good chance to pull all that together and imagine this as my next half of my career.
For me, it's a space to be an artist. Formerly, professionally, I'm not an artist. I write grants for a living right now, which is a great thing to do for a really important organization here in Milwaukee. And it gives me that space to say, okay, now I put on my artist hat, you know, hang up my work badge, sit down at the table and be an artist. And wanting to take and base it here in Milwaukee, create something for Milwaukee Fringe, and then go on tour with it. So work out the kinks, get it up on stage, see what the reaction is, get a video of it to get some production kind of footage, and then apply for other Fringe festivals and tour the world with this thing that I'm doing that's created here in Milwaukee. And I feel like it's my home base. I'm always going to be in Milwaukee creating art. And as I told the Fringe people last year, my application, they said, what are your future plans or something like that, or your goals? I said, to do 50 Fringe festivals in Milwaukee every year for 50 years. That put me near my 80s, maybe close to 90 if I do that. But that's my goal, to do 50. So it also gives me a goal to outlive some expectations based on, you know, we'll just leave it there.
A
long life.
I was going to say, I won't be around to actually interview you in 50 years, but somebody will.
Sample of this and bring it into that space.
I think you should.
Bring you back on. So you can, if you want to improvise a little something, if you got a poem or a song you want to sing,
we're now's doing the time capsule right now.
To lay it down.
This moment.
This is for 50 years from now.
Yeah. No, sorry. I'm way too tired.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's when the best work comes out sometimes, right?
Sometimes.
You just get
sometimes,
free.
That's right. Well, very quickly, mm-hmm. when are you performing during this year's festival? So do you have times?
I do 12:30 on the 24th, so a Saturday at 12:30 in the afternoon.
In the Marcus Center. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Chad?
I'll be doing Valentine 5 at 7:30 on Sunday night in Todd Ware. And then I'm part of another show with the Field Milwaukee. We're doing a show on the theme of protest. And there's going to be several artists in there from Milwaukee, visual artists and dancers and musicians. And we're at 2:30 on Sunday in Vogel Hall. So I get to do two on Sunday.
Okay. And we should say that it's not just theater productions. You mentioned there are musicians, there are dancers, there are spoken word folks, visual artists. Mm-hmm. It's the whole gamut of Milwaukee's creative scene.
Yes, and they have some really great national talent that's coming in this year. It seems like every year they get a couple more.
Yeah, so it's both homegrown, but a lot of other people are paying attention too. Which is nice.
Yeah.
So, well, I want to thank you both for coming in. It has been so great to kind of talk about it in a bigger sense. But I wish you the best. Break
thank
a
you.
Leg, whatever the appropriate.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's the
make a cake.
Make a cake.
Break a leg.
Yeah, all of those things. And here's to a great fourth year of the Fringe and to many more.
Excellent. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Local artists Dasha Kelly Hamilton and Chad Pahochki will take part in the fourth annual Milwaukee Fringe Festival. It takes place this weekend. There's a link to the complete schedule at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North. We'll be back again tomorrow at 10 on another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you.